My name is Mark Brazidis, and I direct the creative writing program here. And on behalf of my colleagues in the Department of English, Jim Harms, our chair, and Tim Sweet, our associate chair, and Laura Brady, our fantastic woman of many talents. And on behalf of my colleagues in creative writing, Kevin Utterman, Jim Harms, Marianne Salmon, Ethel Morgan Smith, Alyssa Hanna, Glenn Taylor, all our fabulous students, thank you for being here. We have a great program, and I have the easy job, which is just to introduce the introducers. And what will happen is Sarah Beth Childers will come up first and introduce our first reader, and she will be followed, and we'll hear from Jesse, and then Kelly Sundberg will come up to introduce our second reader, and then I will come up and make two more jokes, and that will be the end of the evening. So please welcome Sarah Beth Childers.
Months ago, but I feel like I've known her for years. In Kevin's 2008 nonfiction workshop, I read her essays, The Helicopter and Soul Catchers. In both of these essays, I was struck by Jesse's ability to capture place, like a tiny West Virginia town where a woman named Eliza had, quote, a curtained-off toilet, tobacco juice, cake on the floor because her husband Don didn't know how to use a spittoon, huge pots for bath water on the stove, a skinny spigot over the sink that just trickled and sometimes stopped altogether in winter until someone from church would take a turn going over to fill the pipes. I was also struck by her vivid portraits of people, like a boy with coarse black hair she met at a family reunion who was too heavy to ride with the other children on a helicopter, a female plaintiff she saw on Judge Alex with a white-orange ponytail and a red-hair Budweiser t-shirt, and a forlorn girl she encountered only through her voice when a preacher performed an exorcism on the girl during his radio broadcast. I connected to Jesse's writing immediately because I was also a West Virginia girl with a big, colorful family and a fiery religious past, and because of the depth and beauty of her prose. So when I read Glory Bound last semester, shortly before I met Jesse, it felt like I was reading a book written by both a friend and a writer I admired. As a sister, I love the bond between the sisters in the novel, Amy and Crystal, who slept in rooms separated by a thin particle board wall. These young women had made plans together as little girls for what they needed to do before Jesus came to carry them away in the rapture. And then they had to face a world together that kept on going after the day their preacher father's rapture prediction came and went. Jesse Van Eerden is a graduate of West Virginia University and the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa. Her first novel, Glory Bound, was published by Word Farm in 2012, and her work has also appeared in many journals, including the Oxford American, River Teeth, Image, and the Bellingham Review. And it's appeared in multiple anthologies, including Best American Spiritual Writing and Jesus Girls, True Tales of Growing Up Female and Evangelical. Jesse is the director of the Low Residency MFA program at West Virginia Wesleyan College. Please join me in welcoming back to WVU, Jesse Van Eerden.
Thanks, Sarah Beth. How's that sound? Is that okay? We were trying to coordinate our outputs, if you know. I'm really pleased tonight to read with one of my foremost important teachers, Kevin Utterman. I graduated here 12 years ago, so it's, as you can imagine, it's quite an honor to read with the mentor here, so it's a real joy for me. I'm going to read a short, I think three sections from the book, and we switched it up after dinner because I wanted to read Kevin's favorite section. So I'm going to start with the prologue, which doesn't call for any background information, but I'll give a little bit for the next section. Sleep blurred vision, fewer headlights. It was the young driver's first run, and he distrusted the truck's bulk and weather. He edged his rig off the road, a shortcut north of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and into a diner's parking lot, wary of the wheels sluicing the gray slush. He eased to a stop beside a white delivery truck and stepped out of the cab into darkness thick as pond water. He had to swim toward surface, toward moon, the diner's core sign. A bell shook when he opened the door and he walked up to the bar where a tall man sat hunched. A wide waitress showed her face and the driver asked for anything the kitchen was willing to serve up this late. She nodded, bobbing her high bleached hair and disappeared. He sat three stools down from the bent man and took up a pen sitting by the register, a fake flower glued on top. He fingered the petals and looked down the counter. The man was backlit by the window's neon sign, mostly silhouette. Black wavy hair, black jeans, black wool shirt. His face was cloudy, indistinct, and the driver rubbed his eyes as though still seeing through sleep. "Bad out," the driver said after a while. He waited and spun the pen pedals, skittish, the loominess of his cab more palpable beside the shadow man. "Too much weather. Thought I'd get a bite and wait it out. I'm hauling lumber up to Buffalo, gone down to Georgia and back. The South gives me the creeps." The flower tore loose, so he took up a salt shaker. "I got a girl in Buffalo I stay with. Glad to be clear of that curvy route, but slick highway can kill whether it's straight or not." The waitress brought out a Reuben and some chips, along with his bill, to say she wouldn't be open long. She glanced at the man in black, but his bill lay unnoticed, no cash on the counter. The chips were stale. "Where are you from?" the driver asked the slumped man. "No home to speak of. I lay my head where it's fit." The man didn't turn, just scooted his plate away, untouched eggs and toast. Slow movement, like moving in his sleep. Talking in his sleep, too, his voice hollow and dreamlike. "You been south?" "Yes, sir, I've been south at every place. But you go to the far reaches and God's still there." Sauerkraut stuck in the driver's teeth. He felt cold. "Must be your delivery truck out there. What is it you deliver?" "Used to be the word of God. Truck's near empty." The man unbuttoned his cuffs and rolled up his black sleeves, studying the clock. He rubbed his hands together as if at a spigot. He turned, cold black eyes set in a ghost's face, and the driver's cold sank into bone. The man raised his voice. "I'll pour out my spirit, saith the Lord. Your old men will dream dreams, your young men will see visions. Blood and fire and billows of smoke, days a coming." His voice, deep voice, nearly sang, such timbre. The driver thought him drunk, but saw only a coffee mug by the plate of food. "I see things." The man looked up at the clock again as though expecting someone. "I see things, boy, coming at me like," he took a quick swipe with his right hand. "I see the cat's dumb, ain't mewling no song, right there in the straw." He pointed to the floor under the stools between them. "Little bird, caged up, don't nobody notice when it's wing, but nobody's doing it, and that ain't all." He slid off the stool, wagging his finger, and walked over to the driver who had quit chewing. "I seen a serpent by and by, one of them thick rope bodies you could pull out the ground and no end. It's waiting in the burlap sack, hot, mean. It waits for a fool to take it up in the name of his self. You deal in fire against God, you get paid in burns." Rubbing his arms up and down, eyes black, but each swirling, the white of them like ice vapor. "I see it. I can almost reckon the hands who's doing it. Now you tell me," he slapped the counter hard, "is them visions or is them dreams? Young men will see visions and old men will dream dreams. Which is it, boy?" Sirens sounded right outside the diner and the driver jumped, police lights blurring the walls and the man's pale, steady face. "No telling which," the man said. "I ain't young, I ain't old. I see more besides, some from the past. A baby dead before it got born, I still see that. And some still to come, all of it bitter." He pulled a key from his jeans pocket and set it on the driver's scribbled bill. Car door slammed shut outside. "You take the truck," he said, "them sirens for me, days come." He walked slowly to the door, muttering, "Sun shall return to darkness on that day, all right, and the moon to blood." "What's your name?" the driver blurted. "Got no name." The man didn't turn. "You call on the Lord's name, son. Them that call out shall be saved." The bell shivered, and the waitress came out from the kitchen with her hand on her hair. She and the driver watched the window as the man raised his arms in surrender. His sleeves still rolled. He raised them high and outspread, the way the driver had once seen a TV preacher, sweaty and gold-toothed, lift his hands to shout praises, to say glory. So I'm going to read a second section from the book, and there are five persons. perspectives that you follow throughout the book. This first one comes from Aubrey, who's an outsider to the town. The book opens with these two sisters, Amy and Crystal Lindley, who are going to see their preacher father from the prologue, who's incarcerated. And they lose their nerve. They haven't seen him for about 10 years since he abandoned their family. After, as Sarah Beth pointed out, he predicted Christ coming and Christ didn't show up, and then he left. Also, 10 years ago, Crystal has taken a vow of silence, the older sister, and Amy a vow of chastity. So that's at play by this point in the book. There are three other significant characters I'll mention. Dot, who's their mother. Aubrey, who is the one in this chapter. Actually, he introduces himself. And Ronnie Sisler, I believe, is mentioned at some point, who's Christopher's former sweetheart. The first time Aubrey had met her, he called her by the name embroidered above the muffler barn on her shirt, Amy, in yellow curlicues. The shirt hugged tightly to her chest, unbuttoned low in the front. Aubrey looked everywhere except down that shirt, then tried to buy the first pack of cigarettes of his life. It was the fall of 1998, and Aubrey had just moved to Cuthart, West Virginia. He felt reborn and purposeful, or at least tried to convince himself he felt that way. He was about to start up classes in town and at the nearby prison. He'd also started drinking percolated coffee that made his head buzz, and he would repeat to himself, "I'm really doing something here," a mantra that helped him overcome his shyness. He was muttering this affirmation as he walked into the muffler barn with a flyer about the GED class and saw Amy pull a wholesale cart of Camels from behind the counter. She slid them over on a dirty formica to a shuffling woman who wore house slippers and whose hair, when Aubrey got in line behind her, smelled like motor oil and sulfurous water. "Sign here, Esther," Amy said. She glanced at Aubrey, then slipped her short black hair behind her ear to show a naked lobe. No earring. She shifted her weight and flicked at the counter with the red fingernails. Her eyes were such a pretty black, almost too pretty, and Aubrey had to look everywhere but at those eyes and at that shirt that clung to her. But nothing he looked at in the room registered, except for an old man sitting in a wooden office chair next to the counter, fiddling with a collection of rubber bands around his wrist. Esther took to what felt to Aubrey like a decade to sign the yellow paper that had written on the top, he had plenty of time to read, "I owe you for one box," and across from it on the right-hand side, $17. No date, no shop insignia of any sort, nothing else at all but Esther's painstaking childlike signature. "See you next month then," Amy said, and the old woman scuffed out with the Camels pinned under her armpit and her hand in her slacks pocket, the way a businessman carries a newspaper on the street. "You got a car needs work done?" Amy asked Aubrey without looking at him as she stuck the sign slip onto a nail behind her. On top of a collection of identical slips, punched through with the nail. He blanked, forgot about the flyer he held at his side. She turned around. "I ain't got all day," said a perfect mouth. Then he said, too loud, "I'll have a pack of cigarettes, please, Amy." Either her face or the thought of smoking a cigarette or both produced an acrid taste in his mouth like metal. "We don't sell cigarettes here," she said. "If you want an oil change or a tune-up or if you want Jimmy to look under your hood, that we do." Aubrey felt her black eyes studying him, looking him over. He thought she lingered on the white Loyola on his green t-shirt, neatly tucked in. She slurred the word oil into a single syllable. "Oil change," she said it so sweetly. He thought she was making fun of him or herself, as though she were acting out a caricature. Still, he liked the way it sounded. "But you just sold that old lady a whole carton," he said, aware of his own crisp voice. "Just her months, yes sir," I refers to the month on credit. "When she got there?" She nodded at the flyer in his hand. The old man on the wooden office chair beside the counter quit playing with the rubber bands on his wrist. He looked up and said, "Esther Motes, first of the month, and Gary Wayne, but he come in for two." And he bowed again over the rubber bands, reordering them, counting them like a rosary. "Well," said Aubrey, feeling his body go stiff. "What you got?" I asked. Amy started to smile. "A flyer," He handed it to her. "We're starting a GED class and job training in town. Maybe you could post this on your door." "I got a job, I don't need a GED. It's a high school equivalency for people who didn't graduate," Arthur said. "What are you assuming?"
"Nothing.
I'm not assuming anything. I just thought you could hang it up for customers."
"This made on a computer?" she asked.
"Yes." "You don't need no diploma if you're going to be a woman prophet of God," she said.
"Excuse me?"
"You heard me. A prophet of God. Are you a prophet?" He was ready to laugh, but not until she did first. And once she laughed, then he'd be able to leave and spit out this metal secreting from his gums. "I will be," she said, straight-faced. Even her smile disappeared. "But you're not yet?"
"Nope, not yet."
"What are you waiting for?"
"God's time."
"How long have you been waiting?"
"Almost 10 years.
10 years? You're asking a hell of a lot of questions. "Sorry." Aubrey could see the dull silvery top of her camisole as she leaned forward lower and lower over the counter.
"Sorry," he said again.
"What for?"
Her smile crept back into her mouth.
"Why'd you quit, Amy?"
"Quit what?"
"School." "Because my daddy died and the sun come up. Why are you looking down my shirt?" She wasn't wearing a bra and you couldn't look anywhere else except at silver camisole.
"You're slick with my name, so what's your name, Guy?"
"Aubrey Falls."
"He falls indeed. You tell me, Mr. Aubrey Falls, you know the Lord Jesus in a personal way, as the Lord of your salvation." He said nothing to that, just a quick exhaled metal-coated breath. He retreated quickly into himself. He felt like a character in some ridiculous movie, playing the butt of the joke. How he'd always felt when he left his college friends' late parties alone and walked down the streets in Chicago, looking at his face in shop windows in search of someone who took him seriously. This strange woman, this angel-faced girl in a skimpy work shirt, and a voice that slipped his long fingers around him, did not take him seriously.
"Come here," Amy said quietly, glancing over at the rubber band man who didn't seem to be watching. "Lean on over here for a girl going to woman prophet." Aubrey couldn't move. He heard his dad's voice in his head, his doctor voice speaking under an icy sheet of irony when they had once watched a televangelist endorse a city councilman on a show, the two suited men shaking hands on the screen. Politicians and prophets, his dad had said, two roles played by the same clown. When Aubrey's dad had died, another physician had offered the eulogy in that same clinical voice.
"Come on," Amy said, and Aubrey leaned in with some effort, his body like lid.
"A little closer," she said. He was close enough to taste the smoke and underneath the black coffee of her mouth, and she whispered, "Don't you know I'm a virgin, and I plan to stay one till I'm a prophet, till after the trials and the tribulation and the battle of Armageddon, when the trump shall sound. She reached down in a flash and swiped her hand hard over the front of his pants, and he leaped back, stunned. "Ain't nobody who flinches worth the powder to blow him up," she said, and started laughing, and the rubber band man, who in fact had been watching, cackled harshly. Aubrey backed up to the shop door, feeling his whole body turn red, feeling the buzz in his head swell with his purposeful mantra and this woman's gaping shirt front and his dad's voice, and it all burst into tiny shards of laughter that pounced on him from everywhere in the shop. He felt his own recognition of himself dissolve into the black pools of Amy's eyes as she laughed.
"Yeah," she said, "I'll stick this here flyer up for you, Aubrey." And she pierced the flyer onto the nail on top of Esther Moat's credit cards. So I'm going to read just one more section, and this goes back to 10 years prior, pretty much right after their dad's prediction went bust and he left. And they are 16 and 14, the two sisters. This is in Crystal's perspective. And, you know, somewhat desperate. And doing their best to support one another. So this is where I'll close. One night in September, Dot, who again is their mom, locked herself in her bedroom and didn't come out. Crystal taught Amy to make biscuits that night for supper of biscuits with margarine and salt. When Crystal said grace over the biscuits, she heard Cord's voice in her own. Cord is their father's name, who was the preacher. And her mouth tasted ashes. She quit before the amen and asked Amy, believe he's coming back? No, Amy said, because he done took the money Mom kept in the bread box. No, I mean Jesus. Do you believe in the Lord's return? Amy stared at her. I don't know. I did before. Can we just eat? See, I think this is a test, Crystal said. God's testing our faith. I mean, God's name don't belong to him who mars it. That's what I've been thinking. And we got to call on his name. God's testing us, and you're wavering. I ain't wavering, Amy said. Two women will be grinding grain, Amy. One will be taken and the other left in the twinkling of an eye. I said I ain't wavering. Two will be there in the fields, and I ain't doubting it, Chris. You sounded to me like you was doubting.
Well, I ain't.
All right. And it's you who's doubting. And then softer, you're doubting me, Amy Jo. All at once, Crystal felt the separateness that had been wedged between them during the time of their daddy's prophecies. She had left Amy behind, the sheep she was meant to tend. I left her in that ring of split rail fence alone. Amy looked hard at the biscuits, hungry, but hungry for more than their flaky crusts could give her. Two girls would be eating a meal of biscuits in a double wide, Crystal thought, both left to fend for themselves. I got an idea. Crystal rose from the table and got their daddy's Bible that he had left on top of the toaster, as if he hoped it would catch fire. You remember that prophet that come last spring to preach? The woman prophet who couldn't go up front because of being a woman, but she preached from the corner rug? Amy nodded. You remember when she testified to the power of the word to give her guidance? Like how she opened her Bible one day and said, "Speak ye, Lord, and I shall do it." And she pointed her eyes shut to a verse in Mark 8, she said, where Jesus spits on a blind man's eyes and the man sees people like walking trees. Then she went forth and healed a blind woman by spitting in her eyes. You remember? Yeah, I remember. Like how Mom said June could do. I mean, read it without seeing. June asked for a touch from God, even, and she had a nice singing voice. Well, I think we should do it, too. Do what? Let the Lord speak to us, and we do it according to the word we get. You're crazy. You're just too scared. So what if I am? You're crazy. What if we get a verse about sacrifice? Or the part about washing in the river, you're going to some ways wash in that mucky river, or the begets him who beget him who begot him. God's testing you, and you're failing, Amy. You ain't God, and you ain't in his mind telling you what he's thinking. I dare you to do it with me, Crystal said. You dare me to point to the Bible anyplace, and then do what it says till the Lord returns or says to quit, else it's all shifting sand. If you think you believe strong enough, then I know I do. I ain't no fool. Speak ye, Lord, like my sister says. And Amy grinned, shouted it, even though they'd been whispering, not wanting to disturb Doc. I ain't joking, Amy. I ain't either. I'll go first, Crystal said. She shoved aside the plate of biscuits to make way for the leather-bound Bible. She opened it and shut her eyes and waved her arm wild above her head, coming down with her index finger and reading what she saw by it in Ecclesiastes 5. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and thou upon earth. Therefore let thy words be few. They were quiet then. It might have been a lark, two teen girls playing out a dare to keep desperation at bay. But it was no lark. Crystal felt far from teenage dabbling. She felt helpless, as though her life had already been decided for her. Amy's black eyes pierced her as her own eyes teared, like there was dust in them. It was as though some voice apart from her had read the words, and she had listened from her chair. She had felt her daddy all around her, felt swathed in his words, led by his words, like he was still there, waiting for her voice to keep on, to follow behind his in a straight path, like in between two rows of tall, rigid corn. She felt her body separating from her voice, like a cat curling away from its own cry, a beautiful cry that had always sung the sweet words of hymns with force and yearning, as though she were rescuing the words from among the snares of the old shape notes on the page. Crystal's voice had always pushed forward until now. Her lips still puckered a little from saying the last word, few. She drew them together and thought of Ronnie, to whom she had yet many things to say. She closed her mouth on the taste of the salty heat of biscuits, or tears, or both. What does that mean, Chris? What are you doing? Amy's black eyes teared up too, and she rose up from the table. "Sis," she said. "Sis." But Crystal said nothing, just looked at Amy with a surprise and regretful wonder, and held out the Bible to her. Amy took it, like a soldier obeying an order. "I ain't no fool," Amy whispered. She flipped the thin pages and pointed eyes closed and wet to Jeremiah 16. And she read in the same whisper, "The word of the Lord came also unto me, saying, Thou shalt not take thee a wife, neither shalt thou have sons or daughters in this place." Crystal watched as her sister's lips mouthed the words of the verse again silently, and as her face moved into a series of expressions, twisting and softening, turning blush red. Crystal had watched Amy's face her whole life, when they held hands as little girls at services that stretched so long on Sunday, so long that the girls lay down together on the rag rug in the corner, on the pillow they shared, under the hot blanket of air weaved of the praise and sweat and ache of the worshipers who had coarse voices and coarse lives. She had watched Amy's face go sleepy, then wake up and crease with laughter. She'd watched Amy's face for the loveliness in it that her own face lacked. She'd watched it take the shape that a thousand caresses had given it, and she'd seen it take on the darkness that Amy's own fears had given it. It was a face Crystal loved, and she watched it now as it took in the prophet Jeremiah's brittle, "Thou shalt not," and gentled it, interpreted and accepted it, registered it as something strange and available, like a ripe piece of fruit, ready for her to just pick it from the vine, because no one but Crystal was looking, and no one would take it from her if she picked it. So she did.
Kevin Oderman is a writer, but he's also a photographer. He's used to viewing the world through a lens, narrowing the focus, and honing in on the details. Great photography captures the world in a glance, but there's always more to be seen than the overt subject of a photo. The largeness of the surroundings rise up through the delicate images at the forefront. In the novel White Vespa, Kevin uses his photographer's eye to bring the fictional world of siblings Anne and Paul to life. Always, the Dodecanese Islands loom in the background, not just as setting, but as character. And Kevin's characters are complicated, but heartbreaking and real. Kevin's writing is haunting. Like a great photo, it leaves an imprint that won't soon be forgotten. Kevin's book of essays, How Things Fit Together, won the Bakeless Prize. And he is also the author of the novel Going, as well as a book of literary criticism, Ezra Pound and the Erotic Medium. Twice, Kevin has lived abroad as a Fulbright Fellow, and he is a professor of English at West Virginia University. It's my honor to introduce Kevin Porter.
Okay, the Dodecanese Islands, 1996. And these are the small Greek islands, sort of in the shadow of Turkey. 7 September. I stood on a chair, looping a string over a nail high up on the wall, and then got down, playing out string enough to hang the photograph at eye level. I wanted to leave it behind on Simi, but Yorgos, thinking I'd forgotten it, raced around the harbor to get it to me before the ferry passed off. I took it back, thanked him, and shook his small hand one last time. "Mr. Miles," he said, "good luck on Nisaros." He was still a boy, his wide eyes gleeful and looking innocent. I wanted to believe that Yorgos and Vaso too had emerged untouched, that Paul, for all his trying, had failed to sully them. The photograph looked good in its new location, maybe a little austere, but good. The owner hired an old woman in whitewash. Right this way. Can you still hear me? Okay. The photograph looked good in its new location, maybe a little austere, but good. The owner hired an old woman to whitewash inside and out when I dropped out of the blue to rent the house last week. I watched the woman wipe the place, lime in a plastic bucket applied with an old broom. She poked at the walls, everything about her intent on the job, moving fast, and wherever she passed, the walls were renewed, white again. While she worked, I made three runs on the Vespa in the Mandrake to collect my luggage from the pension where I'd slept while hunting out the house. A couple of days later, I hung the photograph. I took it last summer on my first trip to Sini. My old Nikon had jammed, and I'd sat down on a step to clear it. I had the camera in my lap, fiddling with it, not paying attention to much of anything but my own problem. I was dimly aware that a man had pulled up on a white Vespa at the bakery across the alley and gone inside. He was coming out of the shop door just when I thought maybe I'd cleared the jam, and I brought the camera up and focused as he kickstarted the Vespa and began to move. I snapped off a shot without thinking, testing more than anything, to see if the thing was going to work. I forgot all about that shot until I developed the role back in the States. Even as the image took shape in the tray, I felt it taking possession of me. The picture of a man in white on a white Vespa. He wears a battered straw hat with a wide brim, just bending up as it catches the wind. He wears a loose canvas sport jacket over a white shirt open at the neck and white boat pants frayed at the cuff. He looks comfortably rumpled and not over clean. He wears dark wire-rimmed glasses. He wears a dark beard and has dark hair almost to the shoulders, both a little grizzled. He is leaning forward and into the turn he is just beginning, the Vespa under him white and soft. White and old, softly battered. Two baguettes pinned under his arm press ahead of him into the free air like an open beak. He is framed by the door of the bakery, the shop dusty within, but the figure of the man on the Vespa is suffused in white light. Slows. Later, I enlarged the image to 11 by 14 and dry-mounted it on foam board. I leaned it against the shelf of books over my desk and often caught myself gazing at it. Just an image, I told myself, black and white, but somehow it set me yearning for a different kind of life than the one I was leading. That man looked so sure of himself, free of all doubt, leaning into a curve, into the trajectory of his life, serenely confident. I made the photograph, but slowly it began to remake me. I found myself sorting through the attic, throwing things away. At a garage sale, then auctioned off some old Mission furniture and a collection of antique kilims and rugs, things I thought I'd never sell. One day, sitting at my desk, the white Vespa in front of me, I realized that I was packing up, closing up shop on a life I'd hardly inhabited for 10 years. And now, after only 3 months on Sini, 3 months, I packed up and moved again. Mr. Miles, you meant to stay. In Nisaros, I'm just stopping. Here until I can't stand to be here anymore. Perhaps I'll stay through the winter, as long as the rent is cheap. I need to understand what happened, and even if I can't understand it, to accept it. I spend my days here quietly, alone. The village, Emborio, was near ruin until recently, when a few of the old houses were bought up by rich Athenians and other off-islanders and restored as summer homes. Now, in September, there are very few residents, and I only know a few words of Greek, so talking is limited to pleasantries and purchases at the one small market. I am alone. In the evening, I slice up tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, and onions for a salad. I eat a little feta and a few olives, and drink a small bottle of the local red cena. Sometimes I eat at a table on the roof that overlooks the caldera, the floor of the volcano's crater far below. Sometimes I sit in the walled garden on the other side of the house, set my food and wine on a great four-square stone. A block of white marble from some building down long ago. If I open the garden door, I can see out over the terraced hillsides down to the sea. Most of the living space is outside. Inside, there are only two rooms, a bedroom in the back and a living room in the front. There's a small fireplace in the corner of the bedroom and a large one on the wall facing the crater. They swell out into the room in soft, almost human curves. There are pieced slate floors throughout. Cooking is done in a gas ring connected by a hose to a large blue canister. There's an old stone sink, a few open shelves, and a plate rack on the wall. There's a wood-fired oven out the back door built of fieldstone and red tiles, and fruit trees, oranges, and figs. But the house is small. There's not much room for pacing. So I take my thoughts outside. I take them for long walks under the olive trees, remembering. I wonder how people leave things behind, wanting to, sometimes. Often, by the time I put my key in the door, I'm exhausted from talking to people who aren't here, to Anne and to Jim, and to faces that return to me like reflections on gliding water, the faces of my long-ago wife and lost son. Okay, that's chapter one, and that's Miles Toomey in his day book. Although this passage opens the book, most of the story recounted in the novel has already happened, and Miles has just abandoned Simi in favor of the volcanic island of Mycerinus. While pages from Miles' journal punctuate the story, most of the novel unfolds in the third person, the narrative tracking now one and now another character through the summer of 1996. And the catalyst for much of what happens in the story has arrived on the island of Simi looking for revenge against her brother, Paul, who surely deserves it. In the following short chapter, she catches sight of him for the first time. 16 June. Anne looked at the box of salt fish by the door and shuddered. It smelled bad, but it smelled, and she liked that anyway. The air in the little store was thick with the smell of olives and coffee, spices and newspaper cones and braids of garlic hung on nails on both sides of the door jamb. The simple density of the smells reminded her of the Pike Place Market of her childhood, where she'd gone with her family to buy spiced tea and dates and powdered vanilla by the ounce. This was nothing like shopping at Fred Meyer, where she shopped at home, a store that hardly smelled at all. She carried her basket around the Pell-Mell aisles, trying to find in the jumble the few things she'd forgotten when she bought for her room. Something, the juice oranges, the serrated knife, stick matches, and mosquito coils. The store was busy, and she waited with fitful impatience in the checkout line. A line of tourists buying snacks or suntan oil or fruit from the produce baskets that lined the curb outside the store. She listened to the girl at the register, her friendly if broken English punctuated by swift, clacking Greek. The light shone thick in the store window, but only half lit the shadowy shop. Anne stood there, still, feeling the world rush around her. The couple in front of her, she realized, was upset. The man put down their basket on the counter and mouthed, "Okay." They were looking out the window at three girls, beautiful, gawky girls, who were smiling furiously at an animated man who was laughing, holding out a peach to the oldest of the three. She had taken a bite and a drop of juice had run down to her chin, which he was wiping away with a finger that somehow lingered suggestively near her throat. "Larry, do something." Larry called out, "Hey," and pushed a little, started for the door. The girls looked startled, caught out, but turned toward their father obediently. The man with the peach licked his finger and then half turned to look too. It was Paul, smiling still, as if he was the only one of them more than half alive. "Chow," he called to the girls back, and stepped behind their mother. Over Larry's shoulder, she could just see the insolence of the look Paul turned on Larry. "Daddy?" he asked, head cocked, then strode away. "Miss?" Ann looked around. The family of girls was gone. The cashier took her basket with one hand, gesturing toward where Paul had gone with the other. "That man," she said, "he is like honey." Out in the cobbled alley, Anne's first impulse was to go now, after Paul. But that impulse was weak. She turned toward the harbor. So, she thought, he still has it. She stared at the sack in her hand as if she couldn't figure out how it had gotten there. She felt impaired, frozen. Later, curled on her bed in her dark room, she cried. She remembered, deep as her bones, that she was grown from a little girl who had often cried alone. Nobody could tell. The next bit is Paul's, and I think all you need to know is that in a previous chapter, he's picked up an English girl, Prue, on vacation on Simi with a friend at a sleazy bar in the Baronius zone. 24 June. "Been writing a lot," Prue said, smiling to see Paul start at her voice. He turned in the door to his room, which he just pushed open. He peered at her face a little blue, where she stood in the shadow across the alley. Then he made a show of looking around. "What? No Mary?" he whispered, smiling. "You," he said, "can come in." "What makes you think I want to?" Prue asked. "Not want a little more?" Paul stepped into the dark of his doorway, then put his hand out into the alley where it caught the light, and waved Prue through the door, whispering still, "Shh, shh, what if Mary should hear you?" Prue wobbled, walking in, saying, "She won't. She's out cold." "Put her down, did you?" Paul laughed. He ran his fingers up her thin dress between her legs, and she jumped a little. "Easy," he said, guiding his hand to his loose slacks. She leaned into him, humming, lifting her hands to tug at his belt. "Think about Mary," Paul said. "Fat Mary, squirming on her bed, all alone." "What?" Prue looked up. "Doesn't it make you hot betraying her?" Paul licked his lips. "I think it does." "You're mean," Prue said, a little put off, a little amused. "I think Fat Mary's been getting your kicks, knowing she was keeping you from getting yours." Paul leaned back in, his tongue rippling over Prue's ear, one hand brushing across her top breast, while the other, again, glided up between her thighs. "Don't you?" "Maybe," Prue gasped, as Paul pressed her back against the door. "Oh," she said, "oh, oh. My sister was a Mary, always clopping in on her horse just when I got a girl's pants down. She had a genius for turning up at the wrong time." Paul spoke quietly in Prue's ear, conversationally. Prue panted, "What?" "I called her Andy Interruptus. She liked butting in, like Mary likes it." "But they're not here now," Prue said, pulling Paul toward the bed and showing white in the unlit room. "Let's pretend they are," Paul said. "Let's pretend we're forcing them to watch." Prue stared at the dark ceiling, a little embarrassed now that she had sobered up. She considered getting dressed. Paul was sitting at the table, peeling an orange. He turned a lamp on. She had the feeling that if she didn't get dressed soon, he would ask her to, and she didn't want that, but she didn't feel quite ready to stand up yet. I saw you with your sister yesterday, Prue said. Looked like you were chatting her up. Oh, I was. She is my sister. I know. Annie interrupted. Very funny. But true. My bitch of a mom wouldn't hire a babysitter. She said I should do it. That I would do it. But my parents, they were never home. So I was stuck there with little Annie. While little Annie did whatever she damn well pleased. And if I could talk a girl into dropping by, Annie just followed us around like a puppy. What you doing? Or she'd be gone for hours and then bingo, what you doing? Who thought she could hear the boy call in his voice now, petulant, a whiner, which surprised her. She pulled a sheet around her and started looking for her clothes. Paul lifted a segment of orange to his mouth, watching Prue. I guess it's never too late for modesty, he said. Prue glanced up, suddenly scared what Paul might say next. Don't forget to wake Mary up. Accidentally, you know, Paul had noticed Prue's sudden haste. Just let her get a whiff of you. You won't have to say a word, Paul added, as if what he was saying was sage advice. Paul gave Prue his best friendly wave when she let herself out, but he didn't get up. Not even when she said she'd be leaving Cini in the morning. He peeled a second orange, thinking. Not about Prue, but about Anne. He didn't think she was here to make his life on Cini better. She had to make his life on Bainbridge better, that was sure. His mother, her face pasty with anger. Red-faced angry, but for anger was for people with blood in their veins. And Anne was always telling tales. Sometimes they were true, but why tell them? And they weren't always true. Anne had had a way of getting even by getting Paul switched. One time, she called her mother to his door in the middle of the night by acting scared. Something's wrong with Paul, come quick. And the thing that was wrong with him was that he was frustrated. Their mother had sent Anne back to bed, but marched Paul into the kitchen where, when he denied what he'd been doing, she slashed his ass with a thin metal spatula, a line. What did she expect him to say? But their parents were crazy on the subject of lying, and his mother wasn't the kind to delegate her paddling to their father. Paul still remembered the white flashes of pain and his mother's spiteful determination to make it hurt. And he thought, had no doubt heard his screaming.